and at the end of the day, back it up with a reasonable explanation, period. What I'm going to do in the first part is go through the didactics, and it is extremely, I am not going to teach you spine in 2 hours. There's no way. It took me several years. What I am going to do is point out there are 300 mistakes in the fifth edition guides. I'm going to point out page numbers, tables. I want you to know where to find it, because you're not going to walk out of here today knowing it. What you're going to do is you're going to walk out of here and felt like you just walked out of your board exam. You didn't know whether you did well or bad. And about halfway through, let's all stand up and take a break. But I don't want to take a whole lot of questions because I want to give you the information as possible or as fast as possible, and they aren't giving us that much time. The first part is purely didactic. I'm going to skim through the highlights of it, circle the things that are important, because a year from now, I want you to be able to come back to this with the notes, know where to look, because you're going to see every one of these questions, because an attorney is going to ask you, because they're taking the same course, because we're teaching it, because it's mandated. And everything becomes argumentative. The answer is, if you just give a reasonable explanation to everything, it won't. You can just back up your report, and that's all you're supposed to do. Give a reasonable explanation. There is no black and white in this. So, I'm including, and I got a boo on this in the first time, I'm including references to the fourth edition. It's not mandated here. But my point here is, if you don't know about history, you're doomed to repeat the same mistakes. And where a lot of this comes from, came from the second, and particularly the third and fourth editions, and there's some changes, and without just having a reference of where to go back to understand how they got from point A to point B, it just won't make any sense. So I've included it. I'm not teaching the fourth. It's just there for completeness. At the end of the didactics, I've got 5 case histories. We'll get through as many as we can. They are not perfect examples. I don't want to argue the points of each one or you give me the little idiosyncrasies of each one. They're only a guide to how you could approach it or how you could explain it using different approaches. But there's no right or wrong answer. Okay, that's the whole moral to this. So, spinal impairment, what's new, how do we get here? Dr. Mark Melhorn, Jim Talmadge, and I, and the rest of the board of directors of ADEP, we don't mind a phone call or an email. If you have a question, please use us as a reference, because this takes sometimes some years to really understand what you're doing and feel comfortable with it. So, when all else fails, read the instructions, know where you're getting it from, and you're basically going to hear a really dry seminar on a tax book. You need to know the footnotes. Everything's in the footnotes, everything's in the little explanations, and what I've done for you is put page numbers, references, table numbers, where you can use this as a future reference. Do not walk out of here thinking you know this. So, if you think you've had a rough day, and I'll admit, I'm a little tired. We didn't get in until 4 a.m. this morning. I apologize for that. And you think you won't sleep, don't reach for a bottle of alcohol. Don't reach for a sleeping pill. Pick up the AMA guides. You'll be asleep very quickly, possibly within the course of this 2 hours. The guides are a guide, are a guide, are a guide. They are not set in stone. What you need to do is have some consistency in your report writing. And what they asked me, I got a very high compliment in the last group. I've been doing orthopedics since 76. I'm a DO, so we were taught spine surgery. We were taught how to do everything, because that's what you do when you have a blue-collar DO basis for practice. And someone said that I obviously had a bias and was a defense reporter, and I didn't like spine patients. My background is I never wanted to get involved in this. I just wanted to do surgery. But number of years ago, around 1991, one of my trainers loved medical legal work. He loved to sit there with the attorneys and argue all day long. He even had an attorney conference table in his office, and he liked to preside over that. As he was getting a little bit older, he kept asking me if I would get into this, and I resisted, and he started to get sick, so I said, yeah, I'll do a couple for you. After about the fourth one, he died. In Missouri, a dead doctor's report has zero weight. I don't know if it's the same out here. I suddenly had 150 clients. And I got into the IMEs, and man, I got cocky. I'm an orthopod. I know how to rate this. I don't need these books. Well, about 4 or 5 months into this, how many of you have done ACLs? You know that feeling when you're drilling the femoral tunnel and you want that 2 millimeters of bone in the back? One of my friends once called that anal sphincter tightening surgery, when you're trying to get that in without blowing out the back. Well, about 4 or 5 months into this, an attorney, oh, about the 16th question in, nailed me. I had no answer. For the next 3 hours, I wished I was never there. The next day, I enrolled in ADEP, and I haven't stopped learning. So this isn't an endorsement to join, but that's who's out there. And they're taking these same courses, and they are going to challenge you on every little nuance. So don't shoot the messenger, please. The first group started to do that towards the end. You can wear me out today, but I'm not trying to put it out for argumentative purposes. I'm trying to show you contrast. But I want you to write something down. I want you to look this up. It is called Hodgkinson, H-O-D-G-K-E-N-S-O-N, Hodgkinson versus Electric Boat Corporation. Hodgkinson versus Electric Boat Corporation, 35 BRBS 459, 35 BRBS 459, 2001, LHWCA, LHWCA. How many of you have heard about Daubert? Anybody hear about Daubert? You know what Daubert is? Daubert was a case that established in federal court that if you're going to testify as an expert, which you are all going to testify as if you are writing these reports, that it better be based in evidence or they're going to throw you out as an expert. There was another case that came after that, but then an administrative law judge in 2001 said, regarding what we're about to learn about, that this is so written in gold, his opinion, paraphrase, said, one, the guides are a result of a highly politicized process. Two, at best, the guides are a consensus document. At worst, they are an arbitrary system that will provide consistent rather than scientifically based numbers. So, the question is, the green books in front of you that you've spent a lot of money on, are they an authoritative text? The answer is, according to this judge, no. We have found 300 mistakes. We found one more this afternoon. You're going to find a couple of mistakes in my lecture. I apologize for that. But the whole point is as we move into algorithmic medicine and evidence-based medicine, there's not a whole lot of evidence to explain how we will wind up with herniated disc with radiculopathy in the third edition, always at 16% to 17%, going to 10% in the fourth edition, going to 10% to 13% in the fifth edition. There is no science based on that. And attorneys are going to put you in a corner and give you some anal sphincter tightening surgery. What you need to do is ground your reports in reasonable explanations to back up what you're trying to say. So, what we're taking the most of this is from chapter 15. And the major differences between the fourth and the fifth is that the fourth edition rated people, they said you gotta rate them the first day they come in. The fifth edition finally got some semblance of the mindset back and said, no, wait till they're at MMI. That's a big difference because it changes the ratings completely. The fifth edition also talks about arthrodesis and the definition of loss of structural integrity. They now consider fusions. They now give you a 3% range in the ratings from categories 1 through 5. You get 5 to 8, 10 to 13, 15 to 18, etc. That was a political decision decided on in Chicago. You're supposed to, under most circumstances, use what's called the injury model. It's based on a single injury. It's otherwise known as the DRE method. You're also supposed to know what's called the range of motion model, which had been the existing way to come up with these numbers prior to the fourth edition, but is still, in six specific instances that I'm going to show you, is still referred to as what you should be using. And it's a range of motion model that's actually more difficult, even though they say it's easier, than the DRE model, and I'll show you what I mean. So I'm going to go very fast in this because I already have put out little notations, page numbers, circle them because that's what you want later on. So the advantages of the DRE are supposedly based on objective findings, not rewarding aging and not rewarding laziness. The disadvantages, according to the guides, is it's more difficult to do. I don't agree with that. I think it's much easier to do. And you can see that the ranges of numbers in the fifth edition, Gunnar Anderson at the bottom of the cover, he was given the authority to give a 3% range where you can increase or decrease the amount of the rating depending on what category you pick. The other thing is, in the fourth edition, there were 8 categories. They stopped it in the fifth, and they moved it into a separate area called the cortical spinal tract, and I'll go into that. And there are some discrepancies between the orthopedic chapter, chapter 15, and what the neurosurgeons and neurologists wrote in chapter 13. It's like the CIA and FBI. I don't think they talked when they were writing the chapters, so there's differences of philosophy, and I've got my first person leaving already. So, the range of potential impairments. You should evaluate the results, and all of these are quotes out of the book, and I want you to be aware of the inconsistencies more than what's written in stone, because this is the stuff that will help you. So you're not going to come out of here feeling it's black and white. Evaluate the results of treatment and the impact on activities of daily living. If there's residual symptoms or objective findings that impact the ADLs, you are permitted to give this 3% range of a higher percentage, but you're not supposed to give the highest percentage according to page 381. Thus, the more impact, the higher the number within that 3-degree range. There's no specific guidance, though, as to how to determine where to put 10, 11, 12, or 13. So, already, that's up to you. Back it up with an explanation. The range of potential impairments. If an individual had a prior condition, including a prior rating, was asymptomatic, and now with or without a new injury is at MMI and has symptoms, not findings. So, subjective complaints, but not objective findings, and I think is a mistake, that the impact the ability to perform ADLs, the higher, not the highest rating, within that 3% range may be used, and again, it's page 381. So for an example, a strain rated at 5%, later a second injury, in the fourth edition it would have still been 5%, but in the fifth edition you can go 5 to 8. A strain rated at 5% later without injury that is worse, the fourth edition, since it was initially when you saw the person, would still be at 5, but at the fifth, you have that latitude of that range. A ruptured disc with good to fair results rated at 10% later without re-injury, but having recurrent radiculopathy and is worse, you get the ability to increase it to 10 to 13%. And Paul, I'm just going to go fast because last time when I took too many questions, we won't get it to the end. The second part of what I'm going to do after the didactics of this is I've got 5 case histories. If we don't finish them, I walk you through each way of doing it, even from the fourth edition, the fifth edition DRE model, and the fifth edition range of motion model with an explanation for each. So if we don't get that far, or if I fall asleep, one of you come up and just keep pushing this advance button. But read it at some point. It'll give you a flavor of why there is a difference of opinion between examiner to examiner. So, 381, I hope is stating the obvious. If the ratings are increased, explicit documentation of the reasons for the increase should be included in the report. And that's the whole key to this two-hour lecture. Put your reasons. State why you believe what you're putting it. If you can use some scientific evidence, like they like to see these days, add a citation. The advantages of the range of motion method, they say, are easy. I think you're going to find it's harder. Some conditions are better evaluated. You may have to do it because it's a state-mandated way to do it. It made the default, and there's six specific reasons in the fifth chapter as to when you should use it. It supposedly rewards lack of rehabilitation or aging or degenerative conditions. They say that there is no inter-rater reliability. I'm not so sure of that. I have always found, and I'll tell you, as I'll show you later, that herniated discs with radiculopathy usually came out between 15% to 18%. Using the range of motion method, and they were fairly consistent. But there seems to be some difference of opinion at the higher levels. So, determining the appropriate method of assessment. The range of motion method is used if there is no injury, if there is multi-level involvement rather than a single level, either a fracture or a disc herniation, multi-level spinal stenosis, and or motor level radiculopathy, or a loss of motion segmental instability, either done by a surgical fusion or ankylosis. If there is a recurrent radiculopathy caused by a new or by a recurrent disc herniation or a recurrent injury in the same spinal region, or if there is multiple episodes of other pathology, rheumatoid arthritic, etc., producing loss of motion segmental instability, LOMSI, with or without radiculopathy, if it is statutorily mandated, and the major reason, which is case example number 5, if apportioning, making an apportionment where there was a previous injury and the first injury disease rating was performed by the range of motion model, or even if it was done by the DRE model that we're emphasizing, they want you to go back to the range of motion model to come up with your apportionment value.
Do you know what California is going to require? Is going to be statutory mandated in the state of California?
I don't know the specifics of California, but if they're going by the guides are going to tell you that when there is an apportionment issue, you should use the range of motion model, and these are the only six times that you should go to it. That's what the guides are saying. So if that's the law, that's the law. And that's one of your defenses, and that's a reason. So DRE is used for any patient with an injury. There's got to be an injury. If there was no injury, you're not supposed to be using the DRE method. But most of the time, in a work comp case, there's supposed to be an injury. Again, the range of motion is from multi-level fractures, multi-level radiculopathy, recurrent radiculopathy, multi-level loss of structural integrity, and apportionment. Those are the times to use it. So those are the areas of the spine. The overwhelming number of people coming to you with spinal impairments are going to fall into DRE 1, 2, or 3. That's most of the practice. Category 1 only has subjective complaints. There's no objective findings. They get a 0. Category 2, there are objective findings, but now at maximum medical improvement, but there's no radiculopathy. Even if there was a radiculopathy at the beginning of the treatment, it is now resolved. And that becomes a little contentious. I'm going to show you a couple of examples. Don't shoot the messenger, okay? Category 3 is radiculopathy at MMI and prior radiculopathy successfully treated by surgery, even though the radiculopathy may now be gone. Once they got surgery, they're automatically in a 3. The objective findings you're supposed to be looking for are guarding or spasm, but you know that spasm can be subjective. If there's loss of reflexes, if there's decreased muscle circumference, and this is important because this is a change to the fifth, It used to be 2 centimeters in the thigh and calf. It's now 2 centimeters in the thigh and 1 centimeter in the arm, forearm, and calf of atrophy. If there is an electrodiagnostic test or other type of test, discogram, etc., MRI, or if there is a loss of structural integrity, and checkout page, or just circle this box 15-1, page 382. Objective findings should be non-verifiable root pain, tension signs, straight leg raising test, loss of bowel or bladder control, bladder studies, and range of motion model. Diagnostic related estimates of the injury model are on page 381 to 398. What you're supposed to do is place the individual in a category of impairment at MMI using what are now called clinical findings on page 382. And they include muscle guarding, muscle spasm, asymmetry of spinal motion, and there are only 3 planes. It's my understanding the old guides here, you rated flexion, extension, side bending, and rotation. The guides don't talk about rotation. So you're only going to do flexion, extension, and side bending, or lateral flexion. And if there is weakness and loss of sensation, but they don't define what loss of sensation is. Is it complete? Is it partial? But they're going to give you a table that says there's a multiplying factor in which you pick a nerve like the S1 nerve root and you multiply it based on the percentage of loss you think is there. If you take the S1 nerve root and say it's 37% by the book, that means it's completely gone. So you're supposed to multiply and you're supposed to figure out at what grade you're supposed to multiply that number by. That's where it gets a little confusing. If there is atrophy, again, the change is 1 centimeter in the arm, forearm, and leg. And if there is radiculopathy, the radiculopathy must be substantiated by an appropriate finding on an imaging study. The presence of findings on an imaging study in and of itself does not make the diagnosis of radiculopathy. There must also be clinical evidence as described above. This is going to change a little bit, even though it looks like it's set in stone, they reword it later. Electrodiagnostic studies, multiple positive waves and fibrillation potentials, but then they say, don't trust your neurologist, pick out one who can read and write. They do say that EMGs don't detect all radiculopathies, but can detect non-compressive radiculopathies, which are not identified by an MRI or a discogram, and they have eliminated the need for an H reflex. Alteration in motion segmental instability can be either decreased motion secondary to a developmental fusion, fracture healing, healed infection, or iatrogenic surgical arthrodesis. An attempted arthrodesis may not necessarily result in solid fusion, but may significantly limit the motion. Motion of the individual spine segments cannot be determined by physical examination, but is evaluated by lateral flexion extension films. So these are very important, right? And we're going to talk about that in a minute. You should also look at Cauda Quina syndrome and urodynamic tests if you don't think they're at MMI, and they recommend that you should do a systemetrogram if it's normal. There probably isn't a urodynamic function. It's probably prosthetic hypertrophy in males. For fractures, there are certain spine fractures that may lead to significant impairment and yet not demonstrate any of the differentiators. An undisplaced posterior element fracture may not. Displaced posterior element fractures may. And there are compression fractures, and that you need to take that into consideration. So let's talk about the lumbar spine. If you're using the DRE category and there's no muscle guarding, no neurologic changes, no alteration on motion segmental instability, and no findings at the time of the examination, and there's no fracture, they get a 0. They're at MMI. Every one of these implies there was an injury, now they're at MMI. You didn't find any of this, they get a 0. Category 1. Category 2 is a range of 5 to 8%. And they have to have either findings of muscle spasm, non-verifiable root pain, radiculitis, history of radiculopathy that is resolved without surgery, even with, and they have to have a positive imaging study, so they had a herniated disc, but now everything's resolved, normal exam, or a compression fracture of less than 25%, you put them into category 2 and you decide what range you want to put them at. Category 3 is 10 to 13%, and as I told you by the range of motion model I'm going to show you, where you still have to default to in 6 specific conditions, it's going to come out to be 16 to 18%, and at some point you're going to be questioned by an attorney, well, how come you can get 16 or 18, how come you're only given 13 here? Okay? That's where the gray part of it's only a guide comes in, and you need to explain. So in category 3, radiculopathy with a positive imaging study or surgery for radiculopathy or a compression fracture of 25 to 50%. Category 4 is for loss of motion segmental instability, spondylolisthesis that is symptomatic. It's defined as flexion and extension on the x-rays of at least 4.5 millimeters of translation or angular motion at 15 degrees at L1-2, L2-3, L3-4, or greater than 20 degrees at L4-5, or greater than 25 degrees at L5-S1. Quite frankly, I don't do all that. If you start doing all these things, you're going to have one person a day in your office. Do what is reasonable. There is an error on page 379, which says that the difference is between two adjacent motion segments, but it can't apply because the DRE method said it's only talking about one segment. What they meant was two adjacent vertebrae. So that's one of the 301 mistakes. So these motion extension x-rays are really important. They show you how to look at it. This is the fourth edition. In the fifth edition, they added the criteria that it had to be 4.5 millimeters of translation. And on page 379, they measured it on one single film without doing lateral flexion extension films. 379 is a mistake. It's also not the sum of the measurements on two superimposed films. But in most cases, practically speaking, I can't say that I recall a case where there was motion this way on flexion and motion in extension, where there was instability in both directions. If you've seen it, I just don't recall a case, but I'm a little tired today. Figure 15.3 is wrong, it's incomplete, it should show both the flexion and extension view. You're then supposed to take the measurement and it should be greater than those angles or greater than the millimeters that I gave you. So they said that these x-rays are very important, so who needs them? On page 379, when routine x-rays are normal and severe trauma is absent, motion segment alteration is rare. Thus, they now say, flexion and extension x-rays are indicated only when the physician suspects motion segmental alteration from the history or findings on routine x-rays, but they don't define what they're talking about. What they've based this on is a number of studies done in 1990 by Schaefer, but Schaefer took the blue arrow diagram, the AMA decided on the red arrow diagram, so even though they referenced Schaefer, they didn't use him in the book. And Schaefer had a number of studies. It's not necessary to go into, but you can download it. I gave you the reference. DRE category Roman numeral 4, besides motion segmental instability, is greater than a 50% compression fracture of one vertebral body, but there is no radiculopathy in category 4. The rating for category 4 is anywhere from 20 to 23%. The biggest change, the addition, the fifth edition, is fusion. Box 15.1 says increased motion or decreased motion secondary to developmental fusion, fracture healing, healed fracture, or healed infection, or surgical arthrodesis. And they say, an attempt at arthrodesis may not necessarily result in a solid effusion, but may significantly limit motion at a motion segment. Motion of the individual spine segments cannot be determined by a physical examination, but is evaluated with flexion and extension x-rays, which on the previous slide they said are rarely indicated. So I hope you're getting a flavor of there's inconsistencies. So since there's inconsistencies, lawyers don't deal with inconsistencies. They want it black and white, depending on who's their client. You have to give a reasonable explanation of what you're trying to do. And I can't say that. That's the whole message to take home. Know the trappings of this and explain, because we're doctors. These are patients. In these exams, they may not be our patients, but explain your rationale. That's the whole key of what I can teach you. The significant effusion changes. If Joe had a backache, it would be 5 to 8%. If he had a radiculopathy, 10 to 13%. But since he still has symptoms these days without the presence of radiculopathy, he's going to get effusion a lot of places around the country. And I'm not against spine surgeons, because I've done it myself. He usually ends up worse. Someone's awake. So logically, his impairment should be greater. In the fifth edition, it would be category Roman numeral 4 if there's no radiculopathy, or category 5 that I'm going to show you in a minute. That is motion segmental instability plus a radiculopathy. So Roman numeral category 5, DRE category 5, is you have, it's a sum of DRE 3, radiculopathy, and DRE 4, loss of range of motion, segmental instability, that you combine, but you don't have to combine it. They already decided that if you have those two combinations, it goes automatically into category 5. It also applies to patients who have fractures of greater than 50% compression of, again, one vertebral body with unilateral neurologic compromise. If it's more than that, you have to then go into what I'm going to talk about with a range of motion model of figuring this out. So there's six scenarios. There's no findings, minor findings, radiculopathy at the time of exam, radiculopathy resolved without surgery, radiculopathy resolved with surgery, and radiculopathy unresolved with surgery, which is a summation of everything we just talked about. In the fourth edition, beyond categories 1 through 5, they then had 6, 7, and 8. And that's why I'm referring back to that. You got to know where it comes from. In the fifth edition, they replaced 6, 7, and 8. And they replaced it with a term, rate the neurologic deficit using the neurologic chapter in chapter 13. But if you go to chapter 13, it doesn't say the same thing as what, even though they're telling you to go back to chapter 13, they also then say, but if you don't want to go back to chapter 13, you can stay in chapter 15 and go to table 15.6 on page 396 and 397. There's only one problem. The neurologist wrote how to figure up the rating one way. The orthopedic surgeons in chapter 15 wrote up the same things consistent with the old 6, 7, 8, which are cortical spinal tract involvement, a different way. They can come up with two different techniques within the same book. That's all I'm trying to point out. So in the old 6, 7, and 8, if there's cortical spinal tract involvement, go to table 15.6. It's actually a little bit easier to use, and it's going to be divided into multiple sections. Is there one extremity? Is there two extremities? What's the gait and station? Do they have any bladder problems, anal rectal problems, sexual problems, or respiratory problems? You can go to table 72. And these are the DRE categories out of the fourth edition. And that's where they got the numbers. But in the fifth edition, here's table 15.6, rating cortical spinal tract impairment. If you really want to go home and look at it with a microscope, read this, then go back to chapter 13. You'll see it's two different philosophies within the same book, two sets of different authors. This is on page 396 and 397. So, Once you get to cortical spinal tract involvement in Chapter 15, they're going to divide it based on all of those parameters I just talked about. There can be one extremity involvement. If there is, they give you four classes of how to rate this. If there are two extremities, four classes of how to rate this. Station and gait, same thing. Neurologic bladder impairment, same thing. Neurologic anorectal impairment, three classes. Neurologic sexual impairment, three classes. Respiratory impairment, four classes. And they give you the ratings next to each one. And then, what are you going to do with this? You've either had the person in category 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and now you've got a cortical spinal tract involvement. According to Chapter 15, you rate any and all of upper extremity, one or two limbs, lower extremity, station and gait, bladder, incontinence, bowel incontinence, sexual function, respiration, and you combine all the ratings. Does anyone not understand what the word combine means?
Do you combine the DRE rating with these ratings also?
That's the next step. Were you in the first session? Does everyone know what the combination values chart is? Anyone not know? Okay, a couple of people don't know. I don't have my book with me. Give me a page number. It's in the back of the book for the combined values chart. Paul, you got it right there?
603.
Page 603.
604.
Okay, 604 and 605. Put a tab on that. Those two pages are the religion of the guides. It's the philosophy of the guides. If you buy what it says on that page, then you'll be able to follow the guides. You either accept it or you don't, because it's a mathematical formula based on the first injury gets more weighting than the second, third, fourth, and fifth injuries. The more injuries you have, the less rating effect each additional injury has. So in this case, just assuming you have a number of these categories in the cortical spinal tract, you're going to come up with different numbers. You go to combined values chart and you combine each one of the numbers, and the way you combine it is you start down the left, the vertical column to the highest number, then you go over with a lower number along the horizontal, and where the two intersect, that's the combined value. They've done the math for you. And the key to the guides, I don't know if you've taken upper or lower extremity, but the key to the guides is knowing when to add and knowing when to combine. The only two things you need to know. So here, everything in cortical spinal tract gets combined. Then you should combine it with Roman numeral 1 through 5, according to Chapter 15. Now the question is, they say the exact value is obtained by combining the value with the corresponding additional impairments from DRE categories 2 through 5 for cervical and lumbar impairments and DRE category 2 through 5 for thoracic impairment on page 396. But the neurologist said, don't do it this way. So they come out with lower impairments because they don't combine the two. And so is this double dipping? In my opinion, no. The orthopedic surgeons actually made more sense. But if you decide on one, be prepared for the attorney to ask you about the other if he's plaintiff or defense, and be able to have a reasonable explanation of why you used what you used. Explain, explain, explain. So examples. If there's no findings at the time of the examination, even if there were findings before and no history of radiculopathy, it's category 1 or 0. If there are minor findings at the time of the examination, it's category 2, 5 to 8, and you get the latitude for that extra 3%. If there is a radiculopathy at the time of your IME, not that it was a radiculopathy that resolved, it's category 3 or 10 to 13. If there's a history of radiculopathy resolved without surgery, according to the guides, it puts them back in category 2, not 3, because they got better at the time of MMI. And a history of lumbar radiculopathy, whether it's resolved with surgery or not, gets category 3. And notice the difference. For lumbar spine, it's 10 to 13. Cervical and thoracic, it's 15 to 18. That's been present since the fourth edition. What's the scientific rationale? Answer, there is none, it was a political decision from Chicago. And that's why this, I keep going back, read what this judge says, because the attorneys have this on Lexis. Another example, if there's a history of lumbar radiculopathy unresolved with surgery, you still give them a category 3 because of the surgery. So, as I just said before, with minor exceptions, all the DERE category classifications between cervical, thoracic, and lumbar are all the same except for lumbar radiculopathy. Why could that maybe be? I'm just speculating, but take the number of manual laborers doing construction in America. What's the most common thing they come in with? A herniated disc with radiculopathy. If you cut out the range of motion model of 16 to 17% that was we were operating on under, and no pun intended about the operating on, but operating on under the third edition, which were all 16 to 17%, and then they lowered it to 10% in the fourth edition, you see any financial, political decisions being made? Again, don't shoot the messenger. It's just it's not consistent, and the lawyers will attack you on this. Yes.
In your slides, spinal cord injuries is that your final answer? Do we take the values for each of those subcategories, and are we physically combining them, or is that also used?
The question is on the cortical spinal tract. If you had every one of those or four of those areas involved, you came up with a rating for each. You combine each one of them first, then you combine it to category 2 through 5 that you started with.
But is that an addition, or is that a?
It's combined, not added. Right. Yes. And again, I'm only going to take a very few questions. If not, we could be here till 7 tonight.
What this teacher just mentioned is it you add them by history or by proof, by exam?
It should be based on objective findings in the exam and findings in the medical record. You are an advocate.
Sexual history.
Sexual history.
Yes, you're going to give percentage of sex, so how do you prove it? Or you just take their word for it?
It could be benign prosthetic hypertrophy. Okay, you can say they're not at MMI. I recommend they go to your urologist and get tested for that, and give out the test you want to give. We'll let the urologist be up to that. But technically, you're not at MMI yet. Make the recommendations to do that. They're not at MMI yet. I recommend that these things be done before they reach MMI. Okay? Now, while I say that, it's nice to say that, but attorneys and governments do not like to pay you for a reevaluation. That means more money in your pocket.
Before I'm the attorney, give me your mind. When does that occur?
When they're not getting any better, and it can reasonably be expected that over the next 24 months, they're not going to increase or decrease by 2 to 3.
Or somebody of competent authority declares, or does it just exist?
It's your decision unless it's statutorily mandated. In the state of Texas, no matter where they're at 24 months into the injury, they're called statutory maximum medical improvement. But in Texas, they also allow you to keep treating them until they're at regular maximum medical improvement. So, okay, I hope that explains that. All right. Range of motion model. You're not supposed to use this according, you're always supposed to use a DRE except for 6 basic times, but, and this is the easier way to do it, and let me show you how easy it is. The range of motion model involves 3 components. It involves, and most people do this wrong. It involves a diagnosis, it involves a range of motion, flexion, extension, side bending, each one gets a number, and it involves the amount of radiculopathy to one or both extremities, which is first done on how much sensory or pain and how much motor loss there is. You have to use what's called a severity multiplying factor, and then that comes out to be an extremity impairment. You're then supposed to convert that to a whole person impairment. So if it's lower extremity, whatever number that comes up with, you multiply it by 0.4. The lower extremity is 40% of one whole person impairment point. If it's the upper extremity, you multiply it by 6%. You're supposed to then put everything in whole person impairments, so you have a diagnosis in a whole person impairment, range of motion, and they are all added together, and the lower or upper extremity impairment converted to a whole person impairment, and those three numbers are combined together to give you the final number. Very few people do it correctly. I've just explained the whole thing to you, very simple, but it gets a little confusing.
So do you add those values or do you...
I'll show you. So first of all, the first category is just the diagnosis. Table 15 gives you every diagnosis to first get your first part of this three-part problem. And it divides it into cervical and thoracic. It divides it into whether it's a fracture. The second part is intervertebral disc or soft tissue lesion. Number three is spondylolysis or spondylolisthesis not operated on. And the fourth is spinal stenosis, segmental instability, spondylolisthesis, fracture, or dislocation operated on. And then it goes down to when you should add 1% for additional levels, add 2%, add another percent for an operation, and that gives you the first number of the three-part problem. Most doctors in the United States stop there. And I'll show you why in a minute. Because up until the fourth edition, this was a footnote. The fifth edition, they dropped the footnote out. And the footnote says, identify the most significant impairment of the primary reasonable approach when I'm not quite sure. And I back it up with an explanation of why I did that. If there is multi-level involvement and or alteration of motion segmental instability occurring in more than one level is a DRE, more than one level is not. If there is a recurrent radiculopathy caused by a new injury or a recurrent injury in the same spinal area, they had a herniated disc at injury number one, it resolved, they got a rating, and now they just did it again. This is when you go to the range of motion model.
Ron?
Yes?
Coming off the level, how do you determine that? Do you have two projected bulging discs and you want to go DIE or range of motion?
Okay, let me just finish the last things. If there are multiple episodes of other pathology and if the statute mandates it, and yes, California mandates it, when it falls into multiple levels or any of the other categories, so this is mandated. The answer to your question, Paul, is it's an unanswered question. This is where the medical judgment comes into play. If you think it's multi-level involvement, and you think if the medical record, the physical examination, the history, all is consistent with that, go to this system and explain why. The key to this whole thing is explain. Give them a reasonable answer, because doctors aren't reading these reports. It's going to be the 15th report that some insurance adjuster looks at that day, or the 50th. The judge doesn't care. The lawyers are looking for their own client. So if you give a reasonable explanation, and the key here is if you think that there's multiple levels and it's all from this injury, it still goes into the range of motion model, but what I always say is, my opinions are provisional, pending review of the entire medical record. I always tell the IMEs coming to me, by the way, if you don't know it by now, since 9/11, none of us in this room, in this country, have privacy. And if you have made a claim, there's already an attorney working on this, at the insurance company, your own attorney, whatever. And that attorney has the right to subpoena every medical record with you on it and investigate you with a guy across the street right now with a camera. So I'm not here to trick you, but would you please tell me any good or bad news, because I want to know what other doctors you've been to. Because if this comes up in a deposition, attorneys like to do two trick questions at the end of 4 hours. You're already tired, and the old story is, doctor, I just want to give you just a couple more questions. It's, you know, a Columbo. By the way, doctor, did you ever read this record? If you didn't read it, what did he say? No. By the way, could this change your opinion? What are you going to say? The way he phrased the opinion, you've got to answer yes. At that point, Your Honor, I move to strike Dr. Joachim as an expert. He didn't read the whole medical record. It could have changed his opinion. That isn't a complete report. So you tell the person up front, and when you bring that up in an exam, and we have paper questions followed by my staff interviews them, followed by me, and I come in, and my nurse has been working with me for 8 years. It's like an interrogation. I walk in there, they're sweating already, and then I come in and say, by the way, look, we're not here to catch you, but are you aware of all these things? And if you're not, I need to know. At that point, you usually hear about a couple more injuries. You can identify the primary care physician, the chiropractor, the osteopath who was giving them treatment, and then what you say is, my report, my opinions are provisional based on review of the entire medical record, and no one can challenge you after that because it's their job to go out and get it. So then you make a decision. Is it multi-level, all based on this? If it is, go in the range of motion model. If it's multi-level, but they've been into the chiropractic office for 240 times over the last 10 years, no. And you only rate the portion of the injury that you think applies under the DRE model, okay? So we've done the diagnosis table. Now we're going to do the range of motion. And what you're supposed to do in the guides is give them the benefit of the doubt. The first group had a definite group of people who said, I'm a defendant doctor. They were, and I'm a plaintiff doctor. The whole idea here is we're supposed to, with the same person in front of us, the same medical record, doing the same exam, there's supposed to be some consistency within 5% of the ratings. If there is, then we're pretty much all in the same ballpark. But if it's 5% and 50%, and you get more work because you always get 5%, be aware, the American Trial Association has a data bank with every rating you've ever written. And it's been brought up to me, because I didn't know at one point, doctor, how come back in 1992, you were consistently giving this rating for carpal tunnel syndrome, and now you're not? How do you answer that? I took some courses and learned more.
Oh,
yeah, I am smarter since I lost my hair. But you have to be aware of that. They're keeping track. The answer is, what one of our members in ADEP has always said, don't be an advocate for the patient in an IME condition. Be an advocate for the medical record. Don't take a side. Do what's fair. You know what's fair. Use your best medical judgment and back it up with a reasonable explanation. And then you can use this tax code any way you want it to justify what you feel is in your heart is the right way to do it, because it isn't written in stone. The lawyers will want to make you think that it is. So we've done the diagnosis. And now we're going to do the range of motion. The range of motion is based on a thing called an inclinometer. If you go to a Westlake hardware store, the carpenters use these little balances, and I'll show you the amount of degrees of motion. They cost $5 a piece, but you can buy them out here just like I did for $100 a set. They do the same thing. An impairment rating is based on loss of motion and is valid only if there is medically documented injury or illness with a permanent anatomic and or physiologic residual dysfunction, according to page 398. It excludes limited motion based on symptom magnification. Now, you should also all be doing Waddle signs. It's not scientific, but quite frankly, in this age, they would like you to believe that everyone is a symptom magnifier, but let me ask all the men in this group, last time you had a cold, what'd you say? Honey, I can't get out of bed today. I need some chicken noodle soup, some orange juice, and by the way, where's the remote? That's symptom magnification. The question is it symptom magnification that is with an intent to defraud the system, malingering? And quite frankly, I don't have the statistics, but my staff picks them out before I do, halfway through the exam. When they are a malingerer, They're right across the board. They flunk every single test. The dermatome stops right in the middle. It's stocking and it goes right up to here. Every test you do, they fail. And at that point, what I say, and Jim Talmadge disagrees with this, I will say they exceeded Waddell's signs, and I cannot rule out malingering. He will put, in my opinion, they are a malinger. There's a question of whether we are crossing the line into the criminal area and should we do it. I just say, I can't rule it out. And so I'm not going to give him credit on that part of the rating, or I may call him a zero. But that's my technique. It's worked for me for a little more than 15 years. So what you're supposed to do is get at least three measurements of forward flexion, extension, right and left lateral side bending that are consistent. But then they say, if you don't do that, try three more. If it doesn't work, try three more. Quite frankly, I'm not doing that all day. I'm going to do three, and I'm going to put that in context with the rest of my examination. I hope you all have a little bit more important things to do instead of nine trials and everything. So here's the inclinometer. It's placed, if in the lumbar spine would be a T12 and you zero it out, then the other one is at S1 and zero it out. You have the patient bend as far forward as they can, and you take the top number and you take the bottom number. The difference between the two is called true lumbar flexion, true lumbar extension, true lateral side bending, true lateral side bending, right and left. But you're also supposed to keep records of what was the bottom number of the sacrum on flexion and extension, because you're then supposed to do another test called Titus side hip flexion that I'm going to talk about, that is a validity test. So please examine them with a chaperone, with their clothes off. You'll be surprised what you pick up as far as cafeolae spots, scoliosis, etc. You put the inclinometers where they're supposed to be, take the two measurements, ideally repeat it three times. And again, there is a contractor out here who is selling software, because it is time consuming. I'm not endorsing it.
How do you find sacrum with T12 and epithelial bond daily?
Excuse me?
How do you find T12 contrasts and sacrum?
Well, you can start at T1 and count down.
You can't count it down, you can feel it.
Well, that's how I do it. After a while, though, I mean, I've done 7,000 of these, you kind of know where to put them. Do your best job, okay? To a reasonable degree of medical certainty, okay? What's the definition of reasonable degree of medical certainty?
51%.
Thank you. You're 51% sure, okay? Not 100. So, you then get the lumbar, the measurements in the lumbar spine. And notice what it says here, sacral hip flexion angle, that sum of that bottom number flexion and extension was either 45, 30, or 45, or 29 degrees. And if you get any one of these numbers, you then move the true lumbar flexion into one of these categories. And you can see this number gets higher as we go down. So there's true lumbar flexion, true lumbar extension. Those are the first two parts of range of motion. Then you're going to do side bending right and left and come up with two more numbers. So you have four numbers and you're not doing rotation. You're supposed to do these validity checks to see if these are all consistent. And here is the tightest side straight leg raising test. You start at, you put this over the knee, the patella, and have them, and you say, I'm going to raise your leg slowly. I'm not here to cause you pain. Be sure you tell them that. We are not here today to cause you pain. Be very polite, because this is an adversarial group. They don't want to be there. They don't know why they're there half the time. And be polite and courteous and tell, we're not here to hurt you. If anything causes you pain, let us know. But then start putting an asterisk next to every range of motion that is painful. If everything has an asterisk, it's probably not reliable. So you do the validity checks. And then you go back and you put your rating together. First you take the diagnosis. And I'm sorry, I left out the last part. You got to go to the radiculopathy part, the motor and sensory loss. And table 15.8 shows you what is 100% of a motor or sensory loss equal at S1, 5% for pain or sensory, 20% of the lower extremity for a loss of motor. You're then supposed to take, unless they completely have no sensation and they have extreme pain, or they have no function, which would be 100%, you're supposed to then take a multiplying factor, category, find the category in this area, and then multiply it by the multiplying factor out here. And you can see there's a wide range of numbers. They don't tell you how to get between 61 and 80 or 26 and 60. That's up to you. And you're supposed to multiply this times the nerve root for sensation or pain and times the nerve root total value for motor loss. And then you come up with the lower or extremity radicular component. That's the third component. This is the motor loss table, 15-16, and again, here's the multiplying factor. It's very similar to what they gave you in the hand chapter, in the upper extremity chapter. You then combine the values for range of motion and combine the impairment for all involved spinal areas with the diagnosis, the loss of range of motion, and the lower or upper extremity converted to a whole person, and then here's the combined values chart. And if you have two numbers, and one is 20 and one is 10, you take the highest number, 20, and if you go down here, you move over to 10, come up to where 20 intersects, and it's 28. Why is it 28? Because the religion of the guides is that A, the first injury, plus the second injury, times the sum of 100% minus the rating for the first injury, is what the rating should be. The more injuries you get, the less you get for each injury. You're never supposed to get 100%. In Missouri, everything's additive. You can come out with twice the amount. You can come out with 200%. So the range of motion final answer is use the combined values chart on page 604 and 606. Use these three criteria of the diagnosis, range of motion, and neurologic deficit. It yields the final answer or total whole person impairment. The range of motion model is used to help the physician characterize the patient. The final rating should rarely come from the range of motion model, although I've already given you six areas. And if it's multi-level, how many people do you see with multi-level involvement? It falls into this. So you need to know how to do this. Also, in chapter 15, under spine, is where you find pelvis ratings. Just know that that's where it is. It's not under upper or lower extremity. Okay, so that's not the end. Now I have my examples. What time did we start? I think we have, I've got, what time is it? And I think we, don't we go to 3:30?
Yeah.
All right, let's take 5 minutes. Take.
Then we'll go through
as many of the examples as I can. And if I can't get to them, please read them. And I'll be back in just. So, is there still a question in the back?
No, I had a very simple question.
Okay. Oh, come up to the mic, please, so everybody can hear.
It's a very pedestrian question. He said, in order to use the DRE, you have to have an injury. So a secretary...
In order to have a DRE, what?
To use the DRE, you need to have an injury, okay? So you have a secretary who sits typing all day, says, my back is killing me, it's due to working. Is that an injury or not?
Okay. You've just gone in. Who just asked me that question on cumulative trauma? That's a hot topic. If you're living in the state of Ohio, there is no carpal tunnel, occupational carpal tunnel syndrome because cumulative trauma does not exist. I don't know what they say here.
That is an injury.
Seriously, so what I would suggest is, I mean, the topic is, like we're going to discuss later on with Jim Talmadge, if he didn't already do it, fibromyalgia. What do you do with cumulative trauma? Where I live, they say it's okay. Until this July, we're in Missouri, it won't be okay anymore. Kansas has not addressed the issue. So it depends on where you live, what your jurisdiction is. Know what is going on. Ask your medical
association. Sitting at a desk can be considered cumulative trauma to your back.
Remember, you are the author. You're the author of this report. And if you can find evidence to back up what you're saying, say it. I'm not here to say yes or no. You'd all like to have it black and white, but there is no black and white because every state is different. The federal government's different.
Okay. The same secretary bends down to pick up a piece of paper. They do an MRI in her back, and she has 3 to 4 millimeter discs at every level of the lumbar spine.
What's your physical exam?
Negative.
Negative physical examination. What's your prior medical record show?
You never had a back problem.
Never had it? In Missouri, that would be called a but-for case. Can be not two T's. The legal definition is you may be walking around with something, but for that incident in Missouri, and I'm talking about Missouri, I can't talk about California, but for that incident, now it opened up all the symptomatology, and now it's on the clock of the employer. If there's an accident report to substantiate it, and there's no prior medical records, in Missouri, that's how it would be interpreted. In Kansas, they would try to say pre-existing and we're not on the clock. So you back up why you think it is. I can't give you direction on that because it depends on where you live and what the area is doing. Last question, then I want to go on the case.
Yes, I have a question. Under 5 to 8% impairment of lumbar DRE, you said history of radiculopathy that has resolved without surgery with a positive imaging study. What does define a positive imaging study of radiculopathy? 2-3 millimeter disc bulge, compression of a nerve, a lumbar nerve, and the neural foramina?
An EMG, an MRI, a discogram.
I know, but
you want a positive diagnostic test.
I know, but what would define in an MRI a positive radiculopathy? Is it a 2 millimeter bulging disc, or is it a 4 millimeter bulging disc with effacement of the spinal cord? Is it an excluded disc compressing the nerve root? What does it define?
They don't say. That's what I'm trying to teach you today. This isn't a black and white book. It's a green book. It's a gray book, okay? What I'm trying to teach you here is don't take this at face value. Some of our instructors will say, this is the way it is. I'm not one of those people. Just don't shoot the newsreader. All right, now these examples, we can talk about these for hours. I'm just trying to give you examples. And I'm gonna show you the fourth edition, but I'm not gonna go through how to work it. But I'm going to show you the results of if you had done it the fourth edition, the fifth edition DRE, or the fifth edition range of motion. So please take these at face value. I'm not trying to create arguments, but it's good to argue about these points, and you should stand for what you believe in, okay? Just back it up. First one, low back strain with spasm, but ultimate recovery. 38-year-old male working in a shipping department. There's no history of prior back injuries. You have the whole medical record. He lifts and twists with a 50-pound box, even though we're not going to measure rotation. Immediate back pain, but no radicular findings. In the emergency room on the date of injury, and at the first visit with his family doctor, there is palpable spasm. He's on light duty for 3 months, then full duty. He has no chronic medications, brace use, or treatment. At 6 months, he's having mild, occasional, intermittent back pain. He's not working, missing any work. He's working at full duty without restrictions. And there's nothing in his history that says, I can't do this part of the job description or that part of the job description. So at 6 months, you can conclude that he's not going to change very much, that he's at MMI. His physical examination for everything I just taught you is normal. His x-rays show mild, not moderate or severe, mild degenerative changes. And his MRI, as you just asked, shows desiccation of the two lowest discs. Here's his MRI. You be the judge. So, the fourth edition I'm going to skip. You can read it. There's a whole bunch of references here. Circle them if you need some backup. According to the fifth edition, he's at maximum medical improvement. On page 373, we repeated this. He would fall into category 1 by their definition because there is no significant clinical findings, no observable guarding or spasm. Physical exam is normal, no documentable neurologic impairment, no documented alteration in motion segmental instability, no other indication of impairment related to injury or illness, and no evidence of fracture. He, therefore, is category DRE number 1-0. What about if you use a range of motion method? Remember the three components. The diagnosis on table 15.7, page 404, is taken into consideration. You do his range of motion, and you check for neurologic deficits. And that should include both the motor and sensory components. And he's having, according to the range of motion methods, he's at MMI. It agrees with that. There's mild intermittent symptoms. He has a normal physical exam. He has mild degenerative changes on documented diagnostic testing. So the diagnosis would be none to mild degenerative changes. That gets you 5%. His range of motion was normal, and he had no neurologic deficits. So if you're doing the DRE, he gets a 0. If you think it was a 2-level involvement, you have to go to the range of motion, he gets a 5. You see how the difference can occur, but you should then back it up with, why did you come up with that opinion? Or you can say, if I use this one or this one, but the guides say, if there's more than one level involvement, and in my opinion, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, I think there is, go by the range of motion method and give him 5. Okay? I can't argue with either one. You based it on a reasonable explanation that can be understandable by some bureaucrat. On the fourth edition, you would have gotten a 5 because he presented with problems that automatic, and they didn't wait till MMI. They took the initial snapshot. Case number 2. This is a case where there's a radiculopathy, but it resolved, and there was no surgery. And I've got a couple little mistakes in here. I apologize for it. Just bear with me on that. 39-year-old female lifts a 50-pound box, twists while stocking shelves in the store, has immediate low back pain with left leg sciatica to the lateral border of the foot, S1 L5 dermatome. Ankle reflex is permanently gone on one side. At her worst, is able to do 6 one-legged toe raises on the left with no sharp, dull discrimination on the lateral heel and foot. And this, I made a mistake on this in a later slide. There is a sensory deficit, and she fatigues when you have her do these tests. Her straight leg raising elicits sciatic at 40 degrees. There's no symptom magnification. The left MRI shows the disc, number 1. I don't know why they did it 3 months later, but here's the one at 3 months later. There's no disc there.
Surgery?
No surgery. No surgery. So, MMI without surgery She has mild constant back pain that increases with heavy activity but is back at full duty. Once a year, she has mild left leg pain from the knee to the foot that doesn't limit her ability to do her job description. She's using a leave if it hasn't been recalled. Her straight leg raising is negative. Her ankle reflex is absent. There's persistent loss of sensation. There is 1 centimeter of calf atrophy. We're not talking about 2 centimeters of thigh atrophy. But there's no weakness on any of the tests that you ask her to do. Dorsiflexion ankle strength, plantar flexion ankle strength, good big toe strength. Her range of motion, all the validity checks, she's consistent. She's not failing anything. You check the ranges of motion. And so the ratings. I'm going to skip the fourth. The fifth would put her, and this is a question to all of you, do you agree with this answer? According to the fifth edition, she is at MMI. She's not getting any worse. It's been over a year. According to the definition, .. or the individual had a clinically significant radiculopathy and has an imaging study that demonstrates or demonstrated a herniated disc at the level and on the side that would be expected based on the previous radiculopathy, but no longer has radiculopathy following conservative treatment, from page 383. So what should you rate her at? 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%, or should you give another rating? What's the right answer? And that's in quotes. How many say 5? How many say 6? How many say 7? How many say 8? How many say more than 8? According to the DOE, if residual symptoms on page 381 or objective findings impact the ability to perform ADLs despite treatment, it should be A higher, not the highest percentage, in each range of motion, or in each range, should be assigned. If ratings are increased, give an explanation, explicit documentation for the reasons for that increase that you reported. There was a resolved S1 radiculopathy. There was a positive MRI. There's no pain or numbness at rest. She's able to perform all ADLs. She has some symptoms of heavy lifting. She has no loss of range of motion. And her motor and sensory exams are normal, so 5% is the answer. MMI without surgery, how about if there's mild constant pain that increases with heavy activity but back at full duty, and once a year, the mild left leg pain from the knee to the foot that does not limit her activity, she's using an occasional Aleve, straight leg raising is negative, but recall what I said, the ankle reflex is absent, there's persistent decrease in sharp and dull discrimination, and there is atrophy. The range of motion is valid. So based on very rare leg pain that does not limit activity, atrophy, decreased motion, and decreased sensation, you can also give an 8% rating that's also appropriate. You could also give a 6 or 7% rating. Just base it on your discussion. But to me, I don't care what that picture shows, she did have a disc and she has an absent reflex, she has positive findings, I would put her in category 3.
Yes, that's
okay? So every one of those numbers can be correct. You just have to give an explanation. Use the book to your advantage because you know all the little nuances. That's what I'm trying to get across. If you're doing the range of motion method, remember there's 3 parts. And I'm not going to belabor those. But she does have number C, moderate to severe degenerative changes with or without radiculopathy. That gets her a 7. Range of motion was normal. And they say, if you really want to, as I said before, page 399, I wouldn't do this. You'd be doing range of motion all night. She passed her validity test. There's no loss of range of motion, so in this, or I'm sorry, there's no loss of motion segmental instability. So in this case, her true lumbar motion, when you actually did measure it, because you don't really technically need to do it on the DRE method, came out to be 45 degrees. So she gets 2%. Her extension was 15 degrees. She gets 3%. Her left lateral side bending was 3%. Her right lateral side bending was 2%. Remember, they're all added together. She had no evidence of a radiculopathy in the lower extremities, no motor sensory loss. But you can even argue that with the absent reflex and the atrophy. But in this case, the minimum by the range of motion method would be 10%. So we have somewhere between 5 and 13%. All I want you to do is understand there's various ways you could look at this and come out with a number. You just need to back it up. So in this case, fourth edition, on the basis of what she presented with, would have been a 10. The fifth edition would have been an 8. And the range of motion method comes to 18. My point is, look at the variation. Is this science? No, but this is the law. Know the nuances of this book. The third case, radiculopathy treated with discectomy. This is a 44-year-old patient lifting injury at work, immediate low back pain and left leg pain to the big toe. Exam shows decreased sensation over the S1 dermatome. There's a foot drop with a weak extensor hallucis and weak anterior tibialis. Doesn't improve with time. MRI shows a large disc. There's the disc. At 8 weeks, no improvement. Miserable with sciatica persisting with a foot drop. He goes to surgery with partial pain relief, but no improvement in the weakness. He returns to work at 3 months post-op using a chronic sustained oxycodone, OxyContin, whatever you want to pick. He has some ADLs. He says he's got pain. Someone asked this question earlier. So he's considered it MMI. He's not getting any better. He's already had the surgery. I guess unless you want to take him back to surgery and do a fusion. Otherwise, he should be considered an MMI. And the physical examination shows decreased sensation, the first web space, a centimeter of left calf atrophy as opposed to the right, the weakness, rated at grade 4. He's got 20% weakness of his extensors. He walks without an AFO, but then fatigues and develops a foot drop after he walks more than 100 feet. His reflexes are normal. His range of motion, flexion is 40 degrees, extension is 5 degrees, side bending each side is 15 degrees, and he has a sacral range of motion of 45 degrees, which is going to put him in the top category of that chart. So, forget the fourth edition. Fifth edition, rate him at MMI. Treatment result is now considered DRE category 3 at a radiculopathy, which by definition, significant signs of radiculopathy such as dermatomal pain and or dermatomal distribution, sensory loss of reflexes, loss of strength, or measured unilateral atrophy above or below the knee, and may be verified if they did an EMG or another diagnostic test. And individuals who have had surgery for radiculopathy but are now asymptomatic, even though he's still symptomatic. So category 3 for the individual with a symptomatic radiculopathy either after medical or surgical treatment, or for individuals who have a history of previous radiculopathy caused by a disc herniation. Somebody asked me about spinal stenosis or lateral spinal stenosis but have improved or become asymptomatic post-op. Any one of those things puts you into a category 3. You don't have to have them all, just any one. So DRE3 gets you a 10 to 13. If residual symptoms or objective findings impact the ability to perform any of his ADLs, you should rate him higher. So 13% can be appropriate. However, he's also on oxycodone or OxyContin or whatever. This is where you can add up to 2% more and put a note next to this. Go back to page 20. There's one paragraph on pain, and then it refers you to chapter 18, has a whole chapter on pain, and all it says within the whole thing is you can add 2% more whole person impairment. But you can increase the impairment if he deserves it for chronic pain syndrome. Give it to him. If we do this by the range of motion, the other method, he's surgically treated, so the diagnosis from that first chart is 8% based on the diagnosis. The range of motion, we have the measurements for, and he fell within that top category, and he's at 40, so he's going to get 4% for flexion. He's going to get 7% for extension. He's going to get 2% for each lateral side bending. So 2 and 2 are 4, plus 7 are 11, plus 4 is 15. Just for the range of motion component, he's already got 7 going in. What did I say that is 11? What did I just say? 15 plus 7, he's already at 22. I'm sorry, no, he's not, because we're going to combine them. You add the ranges of motion, you combine the diagnosis, so the range of motion is 15, you add these, then you go to the radicular component and you got to find the multiplying factor for motor and sensory, because he didn't lose everything for sensory and or motor. Select the severity multiplier, multiply the maximum value by the severity, convert the lower extremity to an upper extremity or to a whole person, which would be 4% of the lower extremity or 1% of the upper. 1% of the whole person equals 4% of the lower extremity. So, maximum sensory or pain, 5%, but we're saying that he has decreased protective sensation, abnormal sensation, or moderate pain preventing some activities. He's somewhere in this range. Pick what you want. We're going to pick 50%. Or we're going to pick 80%. So the total nerve was 5%. He's got 80% loss, so that equals 4%. And that's for pain and sensation. That's one part. Maximum value for L5 nerve weakness. The maximum number, if everything's blown, is 37%. He's got a centimeter of calf atrophy. He's got 20% weakness of his muscles. He walks without an AFO. And so go back to the multiplier, the 20%. We're going to put him into grade 4. 37 is the maximum. We're going to rate him at 20. So we're going on the higher side, but you could rate him at 25 and you can rate him at 1. Depends on what you want to rate him at. And multiply that number by the maximum value of 37%. If we choose 20, it comes out to be 7. So the lower extremity sensory component is 4. The motor loss is 7. You combine these, but under 15, they actually come out to be additive, and you come out to be 11% of the lower extremity. You convert that because the lower extremity is 4/10 of a whole percent, and it comes out to be 4.4, and you round. If it was 4.5 or higher, give him 5%. Round off to the next higher. So the diagnosis got you 18, the range of motion got you 15, and the neurologic deficit got you 4%. Whole person impairment, you then combine these three values, and in this you get 25%. So look at the changes here.
How do you combine three values on the combined value chart?
Okay. drawn a blank on what those three numbers were?
First,
you first take the highest number of the three values. What was the highest? Loss of range of motion was 15. So you start at 15. What's the next highest number? The diagnosis. You go across 8, which is 22. And then the lower extremity came out to be?
4.
Okay, so you come down to 22 and you go over 4. 25%. Does everyone follow that? 25%. Going the wrong way. So the key here is look at the range. And then you can also add 2 more percent for pain. You have to be able to explain that, because if you don't, someone's going to come. Correctly. I think it's apportion me, and then throw in whatever you want. But this is how they say that you should consider this. At age 28, there was a herniated disc at L5S1. It occurred during recreational weightlifting at a health club. Personal injury. Severe left leg sciatica. Had a discectomy 8 weeks post-injury. No back pain or leg pain for 10 years, was doing full activity. The last office note from the previous surgeon said, absent ankle reflex, otherwise normal exam, no permanent restrictions, and he didn't measure range of motion. Who does? Not by inclinometry, so we have no range of motion measurements. He's now age 38, 10 years later, on the job. He has a lifting injury, L5S1. Same level. So he has a recurrent herniated disc with recurrent left leg sciatica. He doesn't improve with time and without surgery. They repeat the discectomy 12 weeks after this injury and don't do a fusion. 1 year later, he's at MMI after the second injury, but still has moderate low back pain and left leg pain to the lateral fourth and fifth toes. His left ankle reflex is absent. He has a half a centimeter of calf atrophy and no detectable weakness. His sensory exam is normal. So, he's at MMI. He's not changing. His lumbar range of motion measurements, they're all accurate, are these numbers, and the sacral flexion and extension are 30, not 45. So he's back at work in a lighter job with less pay. He's using over-the-counter NSAIDs. He's given up recreational sports. He hires a neighborhood teenager to mow his lawn. It's interfering with his ADLs. He has decreased interest in sex because it hurts. What's the impairment rating? The first injury was a true radiculopathy, so the first injury was a DRE3. He had a loss of reflex. He had surgery, which clearly counted as a differentiator. The second injury still has a radiculopathy, still DRE3 if we were doing that model. Thus, after the first injury, he had a 10%, and after the second injury, he had a 10%. Apportionment, 0% to the second injury, despite the major change in function. Is that the answer? Well, which method are you supposed to use in a recurrent injury in the same neighborhood? Range of motion measurement. So, according to the range of motion, where there is a recurrent radiculopathy caused by a new recurrent disc injury or a recurrent injury in the same spinal area, go to page 380, get that diagnosis. The directions say, number 9, if requested, apportion findings to the current or prior condition following jurisdiction practices and assuming adequate information is available on the prior condition. That's next page, 381. And then you got to read the fine print. In some instances, to apportion ratings, the percent impairment due to the previous findings can simply be subtracted from the percent based on the current findings. If you were just using the DRE, it would be zero. The apportionment would be zero. He didn't get anything for the work comp injury. Ideally, use the same method to compare the individual's prior and present conditions. If the range of motion method has been used previously, it must be used again. If the previous evaluation was based on the DRE method, and the individual now is evaluated with a range of motion method, and prior range of motion measurements do not exist to calculate the range of motion impairment rating, the previous DRE percent can be subtracted from the current, should be current, range of motion ratings. Because there are two methods and complete data may not exist, which is usually the case, on the earlier assessment, the apportionment calculation may be less than ideal estimate. The answer is they can't give you a black and white answer. Look at this explanation they have to give you. So the options: rate the first injury by the DRE method, rate the second injury by the range of motion method, and then subtract the second from, or the first from the second. If you rate by the first injury by the range of motion method, you have to assume that the range of motion was normal because they never said what it was, and that there was no neurologic deficit. You rate the second injury by the range of motion measurement because it's one of that six criteria that you have to use the ROM method. So if we rate option one, rate the first injury by the DRE method, radiculopathy is DRE 3, 10 to 13%. Radiculopathy resolved with surgery, give it 10%. You must rate the second injury by the range of motion method because it says you have to do it that way. You put in your three parameters, and the diagnosis is taken with a surgically treated disc lesion with residual medically documented pain and rigidity. He starts off with 10%, but he had two operations with residual signs or symptoms. The second injury on that same page gets you 2% more. So his diagnosis at the time of the second injury at MMI is 12% for the first parameter. The loss of motion we have, and it's going to be 4% whole person for flexion. Somebody keep the math for me. 5% for, so we started with 12 from the diagnosis. Range of motion is 4 and 5 is 9. Lateral flexion, right and left, are both 2. So that's 13. So we started diagnosis 12, loss of range of motion 13. That's correct. And then you got to figure out the radiculopathy. He still has moderate low back pain, left leg pain to the lateral toes in a radicular dermatomal fashion, normal sensory deficit, or normal sensory exam with an Achilles reflex that's still absent. The atrophy doesn't fall into 1 centimeter or more, so that doesn't work. So the nerve root, the maximum would be 5% for sensory or pain. The maximum motor loss would be 37% on the L5 nerve root. You go to the multiplying table, 15-15, and decreased protective sensation, abnormal sensation, or moderate pain prevents some activities. It's in this range. We're going to pick 70% just to use a number. Since the sensory exam is normal, some may choose grade 5, which is 0. But since pain is moderately limiting and since pain is believable, it's in a radicular area, dermatomal area, it may be reasonable to consider grade 2 and multiply somewhere between 61% and 80% times the maximum value of 5% of pain and sensation. So L5 nerve root value 5% times the 70% multiplying factor gives a 3.5%, and I said if you get to that point, round it to 4% of the lower extremity for pain. So 4% of the lower extremity for pain, and then we have the motor loss, which was, what did we say it was?
Motor loss, 0. Motor loss, 0.
Right, strength, not atrophy, 0. I got ahead of myself. And so the neurologic deficit in the lower extremity is 4%, none for motor. You combine the two, you get 4%. 4% times 0.4, that's the lower extremity value, gives you 1% of a whole person rounded off to 2. So the diagnosis is 12, range of motion 13, neurologic deficit 2. You combine 13 with 12 first, and whatever that number comes out to be, combine that number with 2, the total is going to be 25%.
You added 2 for penny, but where is the 2 that you added for
penny? The multiplying factor of 70% times the maximum number of 5% comes out to 2. Round it off. Okay? So we have 25%. We gave them 10% because we had no range of motion measurements, so we gave them the low side of 10%. We're trying to be nice. It comes out to be 15%. So the second injury gets 15%. The first injury gets 10%. You follow the rationale. I don't expect you to follow all the math, but do you follow the methodology? Okay? And that's all I have today.